It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We live in a world where people shop online a lot, right? And are social distancing. And in a world like that, shopping malls have become an artifact of the past. Once vibrant places to shop, eat, and just hang out, malls, most people now agree, are dying, and many are already dead. Some thrive. But what can examining malls reveal about the economic and cultural life of our country? And is it possible that mall spaces might have bright futures, maybe as other things? Joining me now is Alexandra Lang, an architecture critic and the author of the new book, Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome, Alexandra. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And just to put you in a little more context for our listeners, you've written about structure and design in a lot of interesting ways, including your 2018 book, The Design of Childhood, How the Material World Shapes Independent Kids. So why'd you turn to malls?
Well, it was really closely related to my work on the design of childhood. The chapter that people really responded to in that book was about playgrounds. And so I started to think, like, what's another piece of architecture that everyone has been to, but maybe they haven't thought about how it has this long design and economic history?
Huh, playgrounds. Now, that makes me think of the one time that I was in the big Mall of America in Minnesota. And one of the things that surprised me about it was that there was almost practically like a little amusement park in the middle of the mall.
Yeah. So John Jurdy, the architect of the Mall of America, his big innovation in malls in the 80s was to, quote unquote, make shopping beside the point. So he was the one who decided, what if we take away the fountain and put a mini Disneyland in the middle of the mall?
A mini Disneyland in the middle of the mall. And in the book's introduction, you say that you were nervous to write a whole book about malls. So you asked people about the idea to see how they would react. Would they be excited? Would they be dismissive? And you found that people almost universally responded, oh, let me tell you about my mall. Talk about that concept of my mall.
Yeah, I mean, as an architecture critic, I have a really personal relationship to buildings, but a lot of people don't. So hearing all of those people say, oh, let me tell you about my mall, I have a million stories, made me feel like people would respond to this book emotionally as well as intellectually. And almost everyone has a story from their childhood about, you know, buying their prom dress at the mall, going on their first date at the mall. And these are the kind of stories that are really fun to hear and also really create like deep memories and connections between places and people's lives.
Right. So people told you about their first jobs, their first piercing, their first boyfriend, their first CD, all because you brought up the topic of malls. Do you have a mall you consider your mall?
Yeah, my mall is South Square Mall in Durham, North Carolina, which is where I grew up. That was the mall where I went to the Gap in the 80s. I love the Gap in the 80s. And also where I read books in the back of the B. Dalton that my parents didn't really want me reading.
Uh-huh. Like what?
Well, you know, it was Sweet Valley High. Not that racy.
Right. And I have a mall. I grew up in Queens, not near any shopping mall. My experience was more the old-fashioned one of a busy street, Bell Boulevard, like the downtown of Bayside, and an outdoor shopping center nearby that I don't think that counts as a mall. But the mall that I could call my mall was from my college years and after in Albany, the Colony Center Mall, a mile or two from the SUNY campus where I went. We would go there to buy music and jeans and stuff. And then later when my kids were little and living in Upper Manhattan, they didn't have a mall experience at all. But we would go to the Adirondacks every summer and stop in Albany for a night. And one of the things was we would go to the Colony Center Mall and do school shopping for clothes and supplies. We would go in August, and it was so much cheaper than any place we could go in the city. And it was such a kick for them going from the big box kids section in Sears, of all things, and then to the sporting goods store and the game store and the food court. It was like Disneyland for my Manhattan kids. Think a lot of families had experiences like that?
I definitely think that. I mean, I also have kids who are growing up in the city, and they find malls this kind of weird alien experience, which, you know, only 5% of the population feels like that, I think. And yeah, I mean, there's something incredibly convenient about malls, especially if you're used to shopping in the city and having to go to different neighborhoods for different things. Being able to get everything done in one place was really part of the original rationale for them. The original audience for malls was generally mothers who had home with their children, and they had shopping to do during the day. But going to the mall, you know, made it much more convenient. You could meet friends, have lunch, maybe your kids could ride the carousel. So what your kids were experiencing was really just, you know, a decades later version of that.
So listeners, you could call in on this segment as we start to get into more of the sociology of malls, malls as part of American culture, why malls are fading, and what kinds of future they might have. Call and talk about your mall, folks. 212-433-WNYC. Maybe you still regularly visit a mall, or maybe you have mall memories from when you were a teenager. If so, call and share them with the class at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Maybe you didn't go to shop. Maybe the mall was a place to exercise. Anybody listening out there who would call yourself a mall walker, you know what that is? Or to eat in the food court and see friends, just a place to be. Call and tell us your American shopping mall stories. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer for architecture critic Alexandra Lang and her new book about malls in America called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. So were they so new, do I get from your book, that there really was no such thing until after World War II?
That's correct. Victor Gruen, a Viennese emigre architect, is considered the father of the shopping mall. And the first indoor shopping mall was built outside Minneapolis in 1956. It's called Southdale, and it's still in existence, though not in its original form.
Uh-huh. And why, I mean, maybe it's obvious, but why did they catch on?
Well, number one, air conditioning seems very relevant right now. But they were really designed to provide a four-season shopping experience. And they were also designed to provide a community space in the suburbs. You know, post-war, the government subsidized all the building of these new highways, and they subsidized through mortgages all of these new suburban single-family homes. But they didn't subsidize a place for people to go that wasn't their house or a car. And so Gruen saw that there was really a gap there, and the mall was intended to fill that gap.
So it's the privatization of public space.
Yes, though without the mall, there might have been no public space. So, I mean, I think I make it pretty clear in the book, like, there's definitely an ambivalence to the mall story. Like, I believe in public space. I live in the city. But in the absence of other options, I think the mall was really a great idea and gave people an outlet they wouldn't otherwise have had.
And though we think of malls as a particularly suburban phenomenon, in your book, you also write about malls in cities like Fulton Mall in Brooklyn, and even more recently, Hudson Yards in Manhattan. I'm not sure that I've been in the space there that would qualify as a mall. Maybe you want to talk about it. But have malls shaped suburban and urban communities differently?
Definitely. Fulton Mall is a great example of a phenomenon in the 1970s when a lot of downtowns and cities were really getting hollowed out. Fewer people were living there. Fewer people were shopping there. And the downtown business owners got jealous of what the suburbs had and thought, maybe we can make a little section of downtown more like the mall. So they made pedestrian streets. They got new kind of signage, and a lot of them hired their own security guards and cleaning people as well to make it kind of fresh and new like the mall. Hudson Yards, I write about towards the end of the book, and I think Hudson Yards is a pretty bad example of the mall because it really lacks the kind of central gathering space and even the food court that I think people really gravitate towards in malls.
Jesse on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. I grew up in Queens, over by Elmhurst, and my local mall was the Queens Center Mall. And now that I live on Staten Island, there's the Staten Island Mall, of course.
Do you have and a story? Both of those have,
well, I remember reading that the Queens Center Mall used to be the mall with the highest profitability per square foot before they expanded it. And just mostly remember going there with my parents and doing clothes shopping and then hanging out at the food court. But nowadays, I don't really go to the mall that much, except Staten Island Mall, all that much, except for Barnes & Noble over there and also the AMC movie theater.
Jesse, thank you very much. And Jesse, when I was a kid, I too was taken to the Queens Center Mall with my parents once in a while over there, like in Rego Park off the Long Island Expressway around there. Is that, are we talking about the same thing?
Yes, yes. Well, there's like three malls over there now. There's like the Queens Center Mall, there's the Queens Place Mall,
right,
which is where the old Macy's furniture store was, and then they turned it into like the Best Buy and the Target.
Yeah.
And then there's the Rego Park, Rego Center Mall.
And I found it a terrible experience for me as a kid because the traffic was so intense getting into that mall. I mean, what we would have to do just to get to the mall, whereas I think for people who really live in the suburbs, Alexandra, maybe you want to comment on this, it's a much more convenient experience.
Yeah, I mean, most malls were located at brand new highway interchanges. So part of their planning was to make it as easy as possible to pull off the highway and into the parking lot of the mall. Of course, the downside of that is like you can't walk to the mall. They're like absolutely impossible to walk to. And also many of them were pretty inaccessible by public transportation, which doesn't work as well when you're in a denser environment like Queens.
Jesse, thank you. Elizabeth in Bronxville has a mall story. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on WNYC.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, when the mall opened in Madison, Wisconsin, my older sister went and came back and told me there were trees inside and fountains. And I was like, no way, that's impossible. And ultimately, we all worked at the mall, and three of my siblings, there are four of us, all three of my siblings met their future spouses working at the mall.
There you go. Do you write any mall love stories in your book, Alexandra?
I don't, but that is a story I have heard from more than one person. Just like the ability of people to kind of mix and meet new people at the mall, you know, maybe see a group of kids from a different high school, really allowed for much more kind of diverse social interaction in places that, you know, teenagers especially might not have had other opportunities to get together.
Chris in Manhattan has a Westchester Mall story. Chris, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going? So I grew up around White Plains. White Plains, they have maybe three separate malls. You have the Galleria, the Westchester, and the City Center in the middle. And there was kind of a class division between them as well. And, you know, you might do some shopping at one mall and then walk down to the next and do some more shopping over there. And I guess I'm curious what the ecosystem is when multiple malls in one city, and you know what sort of the class implications are between those and that sort of thing.
And you're breaking up, Chris, but that's a great question about class divisions between different malls, even kind of right next to each other, with that White Plains example. You're familiar with that, or that in general?
Well, I've been to the Westchester. I haven't been to the other White Plains malls. And it's pretty unusual to have them in such close proximity. But the idea of having basically, you know, multiple tiers of malls like in a greater suburban area is definitely something that, you know, mall developers paid attention to in kind of the heyday of mall building. What's interesting now is that yes, there are a lot of malls dying, but the ones that tend to be doing the best are the high-end malls, like the Westchester malls that maybe have a Neiman Marcus or a Nordstrom as their anchor, because as department store chains have filed for bankruptcy, it's a lot of the middle income and lower income department stores that have gone out of business, and they have dragged malls down with them.
I went to the one of the, I don't even know which one, but one of those malls in White Plains maybe 10 years ago, and was shocked to discover, after having driven there, that they charge for parking, because I thought part of the design, the business model of the mall is parking is free. They just want people to come, and then you'll start walking around and you'll buy stuff. And I was going to one particular store looking for one particular kind of thing, and I was like, what? I have to pay just to park here? Was that a development that happened in a lot of places as malls started fading in their economic viability or something?
No, that's actually pretty unusual, because convenient parking, convenient free parking was definitely part of the come on from the beginning, and you can see it in all of the ads. I'm wondering if maybe because, you know, the area where those malls is in White Plains is a little bit denser, if people were trying to take advantage of the free mall parking and not actually shopping at the mall.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, maybe. Daniel in Valley Stream, you're on WNYC. Hi, Daniel.
Oh, hello, Brian. Nice to talk to you. Love your show. You were talking about Colony Center, and that brought back a wonderful memory for me. I grew up in a small town called Wynonskill, New York, which is about 8 miles from Albany, and Colony Center was our mall. And after the Mets won the World Series in 69, they did a tour, and they brought some of the players and coaches, and I met Yogi Berra there. Huh. And I was 9 years old, and he shook my hand. I just remember huge hands, but he was a really sweet man.
I guess if you're a Major League Baseball catcher, you probably have huge hands. What did you get an autograph?
No. I didn't even really know who they were at the time.
Yeah, right. And there was no line like charging for autographs, anything like that, as you recall, back in 1969.
No, it was a little crowded, but they were just circulating.
Yeah, that economy changed after a while. But that's a great story, meeting Yogi Berra at the Colony Center Mall. So, Alexandra, you write in the book, malls have been dying for the past 40 years, and yet the majority of malls survive. So what are they in many cases? Shells of their former selves?
Well, you know, it's about 30% of the current, let's say 1,200 indoor malls in the US that are predicted to die in the next 5 years. So yes, a lot of those are shells of their former selves, but because malls have been dying, their death has been predicted for some time, we can already see some places where they're doing creative things with those shells. You know, one of my favorite examples is in Austin, Texas, where the Austin Community College took over the former Highland Mall and built a new campus for their college there. And the local public TV station also has a new studio in another one of the former department stores. So the buildings themselves are actually fairly easy to retrofit because they're these big, you know, steel and concrete boxes. And so I think as part of malls' rebirth, we need to start thinking of them as adaptive reuse sites and also think about doing more mixed use zoning so people can live and work and shop in the same place.
Was it the rise of the internet that led to the decline of the shopping mall? Is it more or less that simple?
It isn't actually. Before the pandemic, internet shopping was only about 13 to 15% of retail sales. It's gone way higher during the pandemic, but probably when people feel safe to shop in person again, it will go down again. I think really it was a combination of three factors: internet sales, the demise of department stores, and also income inequality in this country. There used to be a much larger middle class that was shopping at the kind of middle range department stores like Macy's or Belk or others. And many of those people saw a huge hit to their incomes, and now they're much like more likely to shop at like Target or Walmart, which just wiped out the market for those middle range of department stores.
Although you write about an app called Shop Now that's revolutionized how people spend time at the mall. Tell us about that.
That's an app that allows you to kind of search all the stores at the mall for what you're looking for. It's the idea is that you can take the searchability that you used to have to do on foot by going in and out of a bunch of stores and look for the item in a bunch of places and comparison shop before you get to the mall. I mean, I have to say that personally, that is not an app that I would want to use, but it's a demonstration of how retailers and mall owners are trying to think differently about how people might interface between the online and offline world.
So it takes away the traditional fun of the mall of kind of browsing from store to store. Roland in Washington, D.C., you're on WNYC. Hi, Roland.
Good morning, Brian. How are you doing? Great show.
Thank you.
I'm sort of passionate about malls because I grew up in a mall. I grew up in a neighborhood in Baltimore where we were the first black couple to move into a formerly all Jewish middle-class neighborhood. My first job as a five-year-old was a Shabbos boy. And the Rouse Development Company built, I think, the country's first climate control mall about half a mile from my house. It was called Mendelman. What Mendelman did was, when I was a child, I'm the oldest of four, my mother would put us in the car and we'd drive downtown to the high-end Baltimore department stores, Hoshulcon, Tech Company. And once Mendelman was built, when Mendelman was planned, the neighborhood was Jewish upper class. By the time it was completed, the neighborhood was black upper class. But because of redlining in Baltimore and blockbusting, which is how my father got the house, most of the upper class Jews were going in my block within 10 years. While the mall was being planned in development, and black doctors and lawyers replaced Jewish doctors and lawyers. But by the time the mall was finished, there was a clientele there. I mean, Oppenheim Collins was there, Saks Fifth Avenue. There was a indoor fountain, and we actually hung out at the mall. I mean, it was climate control, so there was nothing else to do. We walked to the mall and bought French fries from a Chinese restaurant called Jimmy Woo's, and we sat there for hours. We met girls at the mall. I drove by Mendelman yesterday, and I live in New York, but I'm here for a family business. Uh-huh. And Mendelman's pretty much closed. Sears is gone. The anchor store is closed. And the neighborhood has changed so much that the kind of clientele that would have supported those stores doesn't live in that neighborhood anymore. Additionally, Jim Rouse's son called me last summer in response to an article I'd written in the New York Times, and told me that his father always felt that Rouse built a number of malls around the country, but he built these malls off of arterials that were being built like 684, 484 around cities. They were beltways, taking advantage of the federal highway financing that President Eisenhower forecast. So basically, you had blockbusting, which helped to kill the inner city. Some cities had riots. More whites were moving out. You had redlining, which meant that there was less racial mixing. And then people like Rouse and other developers built shopping malls with Oppenheim Collins and Saks Fifth Avenue off of arterials around the city. So nobody had to go downtown anymore. And I think that helped to expedite the decline of a lot of inner cities. I've lived in Shanghai, and in Shanghai, I've seen the development over the past 20 years. But Shanghai has built essentially what would have been malls in the city. And you see it also in Xi'an and Ningxia and other cities in China. They didn't go out. They built what's essentially malls right in town.
That's so,
and I think that what happened in America is that the malls helped to kill the very vibrant cities that the malls were supposed to be helping. And some people's minds.
Roland, thank you so much. What a fascinating set of observations and experiences. Alexandra, does it reflect things that you wrote about in the book?
Definitely. First of all, I want to say the colors right. Mondawin opened in 1956, just a few months after Southdale. So that's why it doesn't get to be the first indoor shopping mall. But it's so interesting that he brings up Jim Rouse, who's a major figure in my book. Rouse actually realized pretty early on that the malls that he was building outside Baltimore were really pulling people out of downtown. And so in the 1970s, he was one of the first developers to start working to put people back in downtowns. He is the developer behind Faneuil Hall in Boston, Harbor Place in Baltimore, and South Street Seaport in New York City, which he intended to be these festival marketplaces that would draw people back into cities from the suburbs, draw tourists, and kind of create excitement around downtown again.
Roland, thank you so much for that call. Please call us again. And we have to leave it there as we are out of time with our guest, Alexandra Lang, architecture critic and author of the new book, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Thanks so much for coming on the show. That was great.
Thanks for having me.